Hi, I'm Katie and you're listening to the Home Ed Voices podcast, where I talk to people about their home education adventures and experiences here in the UK. This is episode number 7, and this week I'm talking to Kate. We talk about video games and how they can be a gateway to literacy, how it all counts, not just the stuff that looks like school, and how the tools of learning aren't always easy or fun to learn, but how everyone gets there over time. Unfortunately, we're recording this interview in the spring when I had a bad throat and I sound really gravelly, so I'm sorry about that. And now, on with the interview. This week, I'm talking to Kate. Hello.
Hello.
How are you? I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Good, thank you.
Right. Let's go to the first question. Tell me a bit about your family.
I have a 9-year-old boy called Milo and a 5-year-old daughter, Ramona. And as you can tell from my ridiculous accent, I am not British, but my husband is. So our children refer to themselves as Britican or Americish.
That's so cute.
And they've lived on both sides of the pond, that Ramona doesn't remember much of America. So we're interesting in that way, I suppose.
Did you ever home... I don't know how old Milo was when you were in the US. Did you home educate in the US at all, or was he not old enough?
Well, I guess that depends on which school system you're going by.
Right. So
Milo actually did a year of preschool when I was pregnant, and he hated that, which worked out really well for me because I always wanted to home ed, but my husband wasn't sold on it. And actually, the extent to which he hated gluing macaroni on paper told him that, you know, there was no way school was going to work for him, not, you know, at the age of 4 or 5. So we started homeschooling at 4. Which, you know, if we had been in this country, you know, it would have been officially homeschooling. So that was always kind of in our minds, that the two school systems didn't quite match up.
Is it older in the US then?
We start at 5.
Right.
Yeah. So by US standards, we weren't home educating. We were still in sort of preschool phase. But at 4, knowing that there was a good chance we'd move back to the UK, we did start doing some stuff. Which didn't go down very well. So all the more reason to carry on home education.
With Milo, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just trying to do, like, any kind of phonics work or anything at 4. He just was not ready. So I think if we had tried him in foundation stage here, that could have equally been a disaster. Which, in my opinion, foundation stage is, like, the best school year. So if that had gone wrong, oh...
Well, it's the one where you don't always have to sit down, and it is still kind of play-based to a certain
extent. Yeah, yeah. So obviously being at home, we were still really play-based, because I got my degree in Oxford, and it was early childhood studies, which is why I'm in love with sort of preschool education and foundation stage here. I think foundation's awesome. It's way better than US kindergarten. So we tried to stay very play-based and still... The bookwork with Milo was a struggle. Any sort of, even like, you know, play-based phonics, not necessarily bookwork phonics, was still a struggle with him. He's a bright little thing, and he knows when you're trying to sneak in learning on him, and he was having none of it.
Can we segue a little bit and say how he actually learned to fluently read?
Yes. That was like beating my head against a brick wall. You know, with him being my first, I think I knew that at 4, you know, we were supposed to, even though he'd shown no interest in it whatsoever. He loved listening to books. I think we started The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe when he was 4.
Yeah.
And that was because, you know, he would just sit and talk through his lunch and it would go cold and it would last for like an hour. And so I started reading aloud to him just so he'd be quiet and eat. So I'm not sure how much of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe he followed it for, but he stuck with it until the end.
Yeah.
And so he loved to listen, but he didn't necessarily have any interest in knowing how to read it himself, because why would you when you've got someone who will read to you anytime you bring them a book? And then we did several different phonics programs when we moved to the UK. I say several different... two of them being Usborne.
Yep.
And then somewhere around 6, you know, I just didn't think any of it was sinking in, and I was tearing my hair out. And one day it was just like, something switched. He just got it. And then from there we were on to, you know, like the basic books, and the basic books flew by in a hurry, and more complicated books flew by in a hurry. And by seven, he was reading Harry Potter to himself. So he suddenly discovered that there was something to reading to yourself, because, you know, your parents can't always drop everything to read you a book. And suddenly that was really cool. So,
can we talk about the Zelda component?
Oh, yes. I always forget the Zelda component. See, if you ask my husband, that is exactly where he'll go.
Because I knew the Zelda component was not the entire thing. It's not possible to be in the entire thing. But I think it's really important. Like, I think it's actually really useful to talk about that as a component, because it backed up all of the work that you didn't necessarily at the time think was sinking in.
I think that was the motivation for the something to click, wasn't it? So, yeah, he was desperate to play Zelda. I don't even know where he learned about Zelda in the first instance, whether it was talking to his dad or what. But, yeah, so he was desperate to play Legend of Zelda, and my husband had gotten him a Game Boy game. And he was like, look, you're going to have to read this. I think Spirit Tracks was his first one. And Zelda's a lot of reading. You have to read the instructions. You have to read what people say, or you're not going to be able to play this game. And he was like, yeah. So he kind of had like the very basics of reading down. But he wasn't patient with it. And he, you know, flipped open the game and just bypassed all the instructions and tried to play the game and got completely stuck. And was really disappointed. And rather than go back and start again, he was like, so can I have Wind Waker now? And we
maybe
were like,
that one would be easier.
Yeah, we were like, okay, but you're going to have to read the instructions. And I'm such a nag, because I was like, you know, handing over the game going, you have to read the instructions. Remember what happened with Spirit Tracks. You have to read the instructions. And he did. He took more time with that one, and he got further with that one. And so, yeah. And then I guess, yeah, that was the motivation for things to start, you know, clicking. Yes, I always forget. Oh, yeah, because I hate telling people, oh, video games are the reason my child learned to read.
No, but it wasn't. See, this is I'm not bringing it up, because we had a similar thing in that when did I get it? A year ago? Just over a year ago, I got a 3DS. I'm going to get it wrong. A Game Boy. I got one of the modern 3D Game Boys. And having been a big gamer in my youth, mm-hmm. and having worked in the industry and stuff, like, I don't know, I kind of got back into it, having been out of it for ages. And we played a lot of Animal Crossing, and there's loads of text in that. And the kids really wanted to play alongside. They wanted to play as well. And they went from being kids who knew their phonics and knew their sight words, but weren't confident readers and didn't like reading early reader books.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't that this game made them read, except they got to practice it. They didn't play it all of the time. They didn't play it for ages and ages. But when they did play it, they got to practice it. And it was a really, like, a massive incentive to practice it, because otherwise with Zelda, you weren't going to know what was going on in the game.
Yeah.
And now my 7-year-old writes me letters.
Oh.
Like, so it's writing practice for her, you know, like in the game, and I send her little letters back. And in fact, with our 5-year-old, I've been sending her letters that I know she will be able to read, because they're made up of words she can either decode already or are sight words I know she knows.
So I'm going to have to get that game.
Oh,
writing is still
cute.
Not one of our strong suits.
No, writing is still not one of our strong suits. My eldest is really kind of, I mean, he does that a bit in the game, but he's not up for it. For a voracious reader, which he is now, he's really still not up for writing. So that's another, you know, journey for us to go on. But yeah, yeah, writing, like little writing, like, yeah. So I guess my point of this is just like, yeah, like gaming has a component, or can be a component. And we know that there are loads of people who play, you know, like Minecraft and stuff, and there's loads of educational stuff that's been built off the back of that.
I shouldn't say that I hate telling the story about Zelda, because, you know, whatever the motivation is, the important thing is that the motivation was there.
Yeah, I know, but I think just even in within, like, I don't know, home education or homeschooling circles or whatever, it's not seen as, you know, that, like, I don't, what am I trying to say? It's not seen as the most highbrow way of doing things. Do you know what I mean? We're supposed to say, oh, well, they just had a love of reading, and suddenly they just opened this book up and the literature just really spoke to them, and then they became readers. And it, rather than, like, they played a video game. And,
I was going to say, if a bunch of your interviewees say that, I don't think anybody's going to say that.
No, nobody has said that. Nobody. No. But do you know what I mean? There's that kind of, I mean, it's like in a previous, in fact, the last interview I had, I think it was, and we kind of talked about twaddle. Because we were talking about the early readers that they just gobble up. That, like, you wouldn't do as read alouds. But, like, you know, but I went through my reading Charlotte Mason-y things going, oh, you know, yes, oh, no, twaddle, that's terrible, whatever. And it's like, actually, when you're in the midst of it, it's, I don't think that's true at all. I wouldn't do, I've done early reader books as read alouds. I wouldn't do, you know, 20 Beast Quest novels or anything. But I've done ones to be like, do you know what I mean? But I've done ones to be like, here is the first in a series. If you, you know, here are some more if you wanted to read them yourself. But we now know the characters, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I just, I guess my point is just generally like, hey, look, there's more nuance than maybe sometimes we talk about.
Yeah. I think so many people go into home ed with that sort of idyllic idea, don't they? That, you know, that is how the reading comes about. And it's probably best just to dash everybody's hopes at the start. Tell them how it really is.
I think, well, I think the thing is, it's like every kid is kind of different in this. And I think it's also, it's different for first kids. I think eldest kids, they don't have other children around them who are pulling them along in the way that younger siblings have older siblings.
Oh, yeah, especially if they're competitive.
Mm-hmm.
Forget about pulling them along. Those little ones are racing ahead. Like, I can do it too. I'm going to do it better than you.
Well, yeah, I mean, the amount of things where it's been like, oh, well, if you can do it, I can do it. You're 2 years younger. Yeah, but I can do it anyway, because if they can do it, I can do it.
Exactly.
You know? And older kids don't have that, because they just see grown-ups doing their stuff. And then if they have baby siblings or whatever, their baby siblings can't do any of those things. So it's a different beast to deal with. We're only on the first question. This is really dangerous.
Okay, sorry.
No. I took us on an aside because I realized it was, you know, there was a real
competition. I can't believe I forgot the Zelda story, honestly. Such a good story. I'm glad you brought it up.
I'm such a Zelda kid. I didn't forget the Zelda story. I really love the Zelda story. It makes me really happy. Well, I was going to say, how and why did you kind of like get into home education?
I always wanted to home educate. So I actually, I had cousins who home educated, and I was super jealous of them. And I actually, unfortunately, but kind of fortunately, got the opportunity to home educate my last year of school in the U.S. And it was bliss. It was awesome. And I just wanted that for my kids. And my husband, having never done it, was just like, I don't know. But luckily, one crummy year of preschool totally convinced him. So, and that's, so, yeah, so, but we do it because it's just, there's so much time to follow rabbit holes and discover new things and follow your interests, and the same answer that probably everybody gives you for why they do it.
But that's good. Yeah, because my next question is like, what do you love about it, which you're answering. But I think it's like, if everybody gave me the exact same answer, that kind of doesn't matter, because it just shows how important that answer is.
Yeah.
The freedom is a massive thing for everybody.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because school was not awful in my experience. I knew how to play the game, but I don't know that I came out of it feeling like I learned an awful lot in the end. Do you know what I mean? And again, that kind of defeats the point, doesn't it? So I wanted them to keep that love of learning that, you know, all kids go into school with, but somehow kind of gets beaten out of most of us by the end of it.
I think playing the game's a really, like, I think that's a really honest way of putting it. But, and it doesn't allow you to be really your truthful, like, your full self.
Mm-mm.
Like, I think school and the way that it's set up, you end up kind of fitting other people. Like, home ed kids don't really do that. They don't, they still have fads and stuff like that, but because not everybody's around each other all of the time, they have much, do you know what I mean? They have much more of an opportunity to just be themselves.
Yes. I was having a conversation with one of the other mums recently about how, you know, as they get older, their interests diverge. And so all the kids that they played with when, you know, they all liked going to art classes or whatever are not necessarily the kids they see all the time as they get older, because, you know, one's always going, you know, like one will be really sporty, they'll always be like fencing or something like that. And so they'll have a group of friends that kind of do those similar things. And so it's almost like, you know, joining a knitting group, you know, you get to hang out with all the other people who like to knit. And you have different friends, obviously, you have different interests, but it's not, I'm making this sound really sad. It's not sad, but it's just they kind of get to naturally diverge in a way you don't get to in school. You're always stuck with the same group of people. And so, like you said, you kind of fit your interests to their interests so that you can fit in. And that's not helping you grow as a person or realize your, you know, your dreams or your aspirations in any way, shape or form.
No, if anything, it can give you just like a huge lump of shame.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That you're not, that you're seen as, I don't, you know, it's hard to be different. And I think home ed, just, you don't really have that as much.
My husband came home yesterday with the best story about this guy. He's got a mentor at work. He really looks up to him. He's a really nice guy. I've met him. But he was telling my husband all about how he went out to buy this ridiculously expensive set of golf clubs because he was hanging out with his friends. And they're all learning to play golf. And he has absolutely no interest in golf. But he felt really left out because he couldn't talk about golf. So he's like, he's really disappointed in himself because he went out and bought golf clubs and he's going to spend his evenings, you know, learning to golf so he can talk to his friends. And it was just like, that's sad.
Yeah, peer pressure apparently doesn't stop, really.
No. No, I have to wonder who these friends are. It's like, you know, don't you have any other hobbies with people who do like the same stuff as you?
You go and make some new friends and then you can just talk to them about stuff. So, what's the hardest part?
Balancing your needs with your children's needs.
Yep.
That was an easy one to answer because I think about that one a lot. Because obviously, children's needs change as they grow. And, God, they change, like, every year. So you're constantly trying to figure out how you get your needs met. And, you know, it'll work for a bit and then they'll change and then they have new needs and you have to change like everything to suit those needs and then sort out where your needs fall once you've sorted them out. Or maybe the other way around. I don't know. I probably look after other people far more than I look after myself. But yeah, that has been the hardest bit. I think also because I'm the sort of person that will bend over backwards to make sure they're really happy and totally not realize that I'm taking like no time for myself or until I'm really burnt out. And my husband's looking at me like I'm crazy going, why are you doing that? Because I love them.
Well, the thing is when their needs change, like, yeah, your instinct is to go, well, okay, well, how are we going to make this work? How are we going to make you more comfortable? Or how are we going to incorporate this thing or whatever that you need?
Yeah.
And we're so used to sacrificing bits of ourselves to do that. As you say, you kind of then have to look at the rest of it and go, oh, right, okay, where do I fit in? And if you forget that, which is really easy to do, as you say, then you go, oh, God, why am I burnt out? Like, you know.
Mm. And not just, I mean, I've talked to people with children with special needs and, you know, there'll be like children with autism who rely solely on their mother because they're the ones that they're around all day, every day. And so even when, you know, hubby gets home and they could have a break, you know, it's not easy, obviously, for that child to then transition from one parent to the next. And you know, you can feel really stuck, I would think. Because that, again, is the child's need. I can't imagine, but...
So what have you done to kind of try and combat that, I guess?
Well, I think we started home ed following the school year, and it took me a few years, I reckon, before I realized that it did not work for me, that did not meet my needs. And I don't know how I would have ever made this work had we stayed in the States. I assume people do it, But they are much more regimented about, you know, the end of the year, you turn in your portfolio and you get graded on it and then you move up a grade and somebody is, you know, because you're registered. And so somebody says, you know, okay, so now you're in second grade or third grade or fourth grade. Whereas here you guys don't have to put up with any of that stuff and have to say it's awesome. Like that extra freedom actually means that I can be a better home educator because I suffer from seasonal depression. And trying to stick to the school year really does not work for me. So we would start in like September, and by December I'd be like falling apart. And then I'd be, you know, like talking down to myself in my head because we weren't getting the stuff done that we needed to get done because I just couldn't. And then in the spring I would drive the kids nuts because I'd be trying to push them through all this extra work that we hadn't done. That was all my fault. And so this past year, I was just like, why do I even do that? I mean, there's so much freedom here and I can do, you know, what I need to do to get this done right. And so how do I use that to my advantage? So we actually stop doing any kind of schoolwork in December, January, and a good chunk of February. It's kind of like, I kind of wait for the sun to come out and then we sort of get a move on again. And we will homeschool sort of March through November. Yeah. So that I can spend all of December and January just carting the kids around places. Because just being out of the house and out of my own head really helps with the seasonal depression. And we just kind of enjoy watching movies and documentaries and playing video games. And so we don't really have a summer vacation. We have a winter holiday. And that works so much better for us.
I think also there's a difference, isn't there, between like the sort of more sit downy, you know, I know this is school because it looks like school, even if it's more play based, even if it's more, you know what I mean, like more fun than school. And the we went to a load of activities and we hung out with other people and they were learning this thing and they, you know, like, you know, they went to music lessons and they went and did this thing and they went to this nature club or whatever.
Yeah.
Like that still counts. But I think it's harder in our heads to accept that it counts. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, this is why I count our holidays away. Because it's usually as exploring a different part of the UK.
And yeah, I mean, I like to consider that we school year round. Yeah. But we just school differently at certain times of the year.
Yeah, that makes sense. And does that work? Has that helped?
Yes, immensely. Although I have to say the spring has been rather cloudy. It's just not helping.
Well, the spring didn't really happen. The winter just went on. And it's like, no, this is the end of March and into April. And it still just felt really cold and wet and horrid.
Yeah. Yeah. And although it's warming up now, it just seems like so many cloudy days.
Yeah. It's particularly in the last week or so.
Mm.
So what is the typical day in the life? Is there a typical day in the life? And if so, what is it?
I'm trying to be. So sort of previously I would say there was no typical day because having trained in early childhood studies, I'm really familiar with sort of Montessori and Charlotte Mason and Steiner, and so I've tried them all. So I think we started with Montessori because I was like, oh, I love Montessori. But I loved Montessori. Milo hated it. He did not get it. It did not work for him. And so we've tried various things and always with what, you know, what I think I can handle, and it never seems to be what he can work with. So we did unschooling, my attempt at unschooling. But again, I think he thinks that worked really well for him because he enjoyed that. It did not work for me because I could not see it the way other people see it. Do you know what I mean? I just, it's not in me. And I had a real question about, you know, discipline, not in like, you know, that negative sort of discipline, like, you know, disciplining your child when they've done something wrong, but actually understanding that for a portion of your day, you know, just like brushing your teeth or making your bed, you should be improving your mind, broadening your horizons, you know, that this is a priority. You know, we prioritize TV time. They know that there's sort of a limit, and they make use of it. And sometimes I think if I put a limit on their learning that maybe they'd really try and cram it in there. Yeah. But So yeah, so we're trying to have a schedule, and again, for motivation purposes, because once I lose them, that's it, they're gone. You know, we sit down and we have breakfast, and I know that, you know, I've got like a captive audience because they're eating and they can't leave the table. so we have been putting on Clemency Burton Hill's Year of Wonder. And so we listen to the classical music for the day. And I'll read through the section, which is usually not something massively of interest to them. But if there's something interesting in there, I'll paraphrase it for them.
Yeah.
So we can do that while we're eating. We just sit and listen. And then we do a poem for every day of the year. So we do our poem for the day. This is why I try and squeeze in all the culture on them while I have the captive audience. Sure. And there's like an app for your phone called Your Daily Piece of Art or something. So I'll look at the piece of art, which sometimes is just not appropriate, but sometimes it's really great. And we'll look at those. And and then we've been trying out one-third stories, which has a foreign language in it. So we've been learning Spanish. As the story goes on, there's more and more Spanish used in the book.
Oh, which they, because I've heard of those and I haven't actually seen any yet.
We've only done the first one, and the kids have really been enjoying them. And every time you read it, they pick up something new. So it's really great, you know, the way that you can read it over and over and over again, and they're not bored by it because they know something new is going to twig.
It's really cool.
It is. It's really cool. I'm really enjoying this. I hope the rest of them go really well.
I can't remember. Is it a subscription or?
It is. So you can buy just three of the books, which is how they chunk them up anyway. So the first three books of the first 3 months, they use all a similar vocabulary in the three books.
Right.
So that's why like the minimum is like a 3 month subscription. Or you can do a 6 or you can do a 12. And obviously they get cheaper, you know, the more you're willing to pay up front. But
yeah.
But yeah, we're enjoying them so far. And they come with extra bits, which we haven't used the extra bits massively because they're mostly just really into the story. And they're like kind of flashcardy bits, which I never know what to do with flashcards. They've never really been into flashcards, so
yeah, fair enough.
So, but then once they're done, you know, they clear their place and then they go and they do schoolwork. So we always do schoolwork in our pajamas. I know there's like this, I don't know, thing about how home educators get to do stuff in their pajamas, but we do actually do all of our schoolwork in our pajamas because if I send them up here to get dressed and, yeah. And then they'll start playing and they're gone. I've lost them. There's no getting them back. So this is like straight into just a little bit of reading, writing, and math, just the bare minimum.
Yeah.
And, you know, that takes them however long it takes them. Ramona, like, flies through hers because she actually just loves workbooks and things. She is the easiest kid to home educate at the moment. Whereas Milo, on any given day, if he's feeling up for it, he'll be fast. But he could have, you know, woken up and decided to read a book before breakfast and his head is, you know, in Asia with the ninjas and yeah. He just doodles on everything and is not there. So, you know, it's kind of working. There's only so much working you can do with certain children, though. You know, it is what it is.
I think it's about the consistency, isn't it? It's like a little and often. Like,
yeah.
Pick it up, you know, so...
Yeah, that's the discipline that I mean. It's just accepting that this is a part of your day, like brushing your teeth and getting dressed. That makes it sound so chory. Like, I wish I could make it more exciting, but, you know, one day they might be self-employed and they need to know that, you know, they do have to do a little bit of work. And they can do it in their pajamas, and that's way more fun.
Well, also, like, you know, the choriness, I guess, in a way, is like the... You know, it's the building up of the tools. So it's a building up of like a maths tool set of like learning how these, you know, how maths fits together. And that just takes time.
Yeah.
And practice and being around it a lot, you know, like, yeah, sort of, you know, 4 or 5 days a week or whatever.
Yeah.
And learning to write is kind of the same, you know, like in, you know, like in Brave Writer, they would talk about the mechanics of writing and then the sort of thought process of actually like ideas. And the mechanics of writing is the sort of, it is the chory bit, that makes it easier to convey ideas once you've got the once that becomes second nature. And the learning, as you say, like the that's like the chore bit, but it's not just the learning. Like they might think, oh, that's school, but school in the learning in general is having the time to read the ninja book before you even started anything.
Yeah.
Rather than just being like, get up, we have to get dressed, we have to eat breakfast, you know, where's your homework, but we're leaving the house. It's having the space to actually read stuff and play stuff and whatever, and that's what the education's about.
Yeah, you're right. I like it. I like that, the tool. That's much better than chore.
No, but it is. It does feel like a chore to them.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
And it felt like a chore to us when we were similar age, because it's not, it is, you know, it's, because it is kind of a chore. It's just a thing you kind of have to do, you know. But that's the bit that they see as school, I think. If you talk to the kids, if I talk to my kids, they would say that school was when we sat down and did, when we worked on those skills. But it's not. It's also when they hung out and bounced on the trampoline, and then when it came in and read a book because they were tired.
Yeah. When people ask your children what they did today, do they tell people all about the video games and never about the actual learning bit?
Oh, they tell them all the stuff.
Or I should say the school bit.
Yeah, exactly. No, they tell them all the stuff that makes me look like we're doing nothing.
Thank you. All right, it's not just me.
But then also, to be honest, like when you talk to kids who go to school, like, oh, how was your day? And they go, all right. Or, you know, or if they go off onto a class all day or something like this, you know, the kid's on a course or something like that. And how was it? It was all right. What did you do? I don't know. Stuff.
Stuff.
So nobody's very good at actually expressing themselves. Nobody goes, my teacher was fantastic and we learned all these amazing things.
Yeah, I can't expect sort of adult response from children, I suppose.
So I held you up. Is there anything else you want to say about the day?
No, that's it. If I can get them through that, they may get dressed and do whatever they like. I'm happy.
Yay.
I'm happy. I'm still trying to figure out how we squeeze in the extras. I mean, Milo in particular would just do history all day, every day, if I could manage that. But at the moment, our actual, like, going out and doing stuff with other home edders schedule is pretty crazy. So I'm looking forward to summer and actually squeezing in things like history, which he could literally spend all day on. He'd be quite happy with that.
That's really cool. What's going on for home educators in your area, Kate?
Oh my God, so much.
I know Kate in real life. She's the first person I've interviewed that I actually do know in real life. So I know what's going on in her area because it's also my area. But go on, Kate.
And it's crazy though, isn't it? We have so many like super smart, super talented, and more importantly, because I'm sure everybody has super smart, and super crazy intelligent, gifted people in their area. But we have so many like generous people who are happy to, you know, run an art class or a French class or organize, you know, if organization is just their thing, organize field trips. And it's just crazy. So the biggest struggle in Oxford is making sure you cut some stuff out to actually give your kids some downtime. It's so easy to be just like the overburdened school parent in Oxford. You could just chauffeur your kids around the county all day, every day. It's crazy.
Yeah, because there's loads of stuff going on across the county. In some respects, there's more stuff going on outside of the city than there is in the city.
That's probably true, because people hate trying to get into the city.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah, I'm one of those people who will avoid it if I can. Isn't that awful?
No, we live on the edge of the city, and we don't make our way into the centre of the city either.
Oh, that's all right then.
There were workshops at the, it's the University Museum, but it's essentially a natural history museum we have in Oxford. And it was like, yeah, okay, I'll sign them up. It looks really interesting, and we love the museum so much. But it's like, I have to take them in the town, and then into the centre of town, and then walk through to the museum just for a workshop for an hour. Oh, it's too hard.
And that's just it. You can only get so far into the city anyway before it's public transport, and not to be down on public transport, but, you know, it's extra time. And I think every home edder does that. Well, how much traveling to actual lesson time are we talking about here? Because it gets to a point where the traveling time outweighs the actual learning time, and you start to question whether it's worth it.
Yeah, plus like bus fares and things add up really quickly when you've got multiple children. Like, it gets expensive. Like, never mind classes. Then nothing's super expensive, but the problem is, it's like, if you could easily be doing classes that are somewhere between, say, £3 and £10 a pop.
Yeah.
You could easily do that every day of the week if you really wanted to.
Easily.
But like, you know, who can afford that, really? No, exactly. You know, like, it all adds up really quickly.
It does.
But the nice thing is, there's enough people that all these things, you know, most of these things actually survive for a decent amount of time, and you can pick and choose stuff, and you can pick what suits your kids, isn't it? It's, you know, it's the balance of...
Yeah, and, you know, I find there's always new stuff in September, so every year, like, your whole schedule just changes all over again.
Yeah.
It used to kind of drive me crazy, but actually, I think if I had set a schedule which would have suited me, my kids would have been bored of it, you know, 6 months in, and it all would have fallen apart anyway. So it's nice that new people come in and take over, or, you know, people who have been doing something take a bit of a break, and maybe somebody who was taking a break last year decides they want to start up something new this year. And so you get like a whole new rotating schedule of stuff to introduce your children to that maybe you never even thought to introduce your children to before.
Also the kids get older. So what, you know, what they have access to changes, because, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a sort of progression from, you know, the toddler group to the sort of, you know, home edy kind of preschoolery, hey, let's meet up, we've all got 3 and 4 year old kind of things.
Yeah.
Into actually, like, no, my kids are like well into primary, and things are now more available to them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's loads of stuff once you get into key stage one. And then there's some really, I think, possibly less, but really cool stuff once you start going into, like, key stage two, key stage three. I think, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I feel like a lot of people do feel like under sevens activities possibly could do with a bit more stuff. You know, they sort of hit an age where they're really ready to do something because all their older siblings are doing something. But, you know, technically, you know, depending on what kind of class it is, they're not old enough. And I think that really depends on whether you're talking about an external provider offering the class and like a home ed mom who's like, wow, yeah, okay. I mean, you know, technically she probably won't understand like everything that I'm saying, but sure, she can join in. So that's why it's lovely, I think, when the home ed moms, you know, offer their skills. Because actually, there are a lot of, you know, like I said, really talented people. I think once we, you know, sort of have children and give up work, we kind of feel like maybe we're not qualified to do that anymore. But we totally are. I know so many awesome moms with so much to offer.
Yeah. I think also that when it's something from it, there are advantages and disadvantages to each side. When there are classes that would normally be school, like, you know, workshops and stuff, they tend to be quite specific about ages.
Yeah.
At the university museum, where actually I couldn't bring my 5-year-old because she wasn't old enough to do the class.
Yeah.
Technically, my 7-year-old sort of wasn't old enough, but because she's 7 quite earlier in the year, I could crowbar her in, even though she should have been the year above, you know, according to their sort of setting.
Yeah.
But my kids came out and went, yeah, she, you know, the 5-year-old totally would have understood most of that.
Yeah,
it's stuff
people
she's
have
interested
these funny
in,
ideas
you know
about
I mean?
Ages, don't they?
Well, yeah, whereas when it's run within the community, it's like, well, anybody, you know, like, as long as your kid's not, I don't know, like you're there with your kids anyway, so, like, as long as a toddler doesn't pull everything off the table that we're trying to work on, they can bring them along. We have a much wider age range, and the bigger kids will, like we were saying with siblings before, the bigger kids will pull the smaller kids along because they will be showing them how a child will do this, not just how an adult who is demonstrating it would do it.
Yeah.
And it makes it more manageable.
And I have always felt like the school system does not give young children enough credit for what they're capable of understanding.
No.
I mean, just as a general rule, teaching preschool and things like that, you're kind of like, you know, dumbing down language and stuff like that. They're capable of so much more, and it's it's nice that in home ed with the mixed age groups that, you know, your child can just work at whatever level they're at instead of being any kind of pigeonholing because of their age.
I mean, look at the amount of toddlers who know dinosaur names. Dinosaur names are really big, complicated words.
Yeah.
And they know them off by heart because the complicated words are attached to massive, ginormous lizards.
Ginormous lizards.
So, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I totally understand what you mean. They are capable of so much more. Yeah. Where are we? Do you have any resource recommendations? For home and parents.
Okay. So I have, because then you have book recommendations, don't you? So
I have like books for kids or read alouds. But
okay.
Yeah.
All right. So resource recommendations. I'm trying to, okay. So I have kind of like, I have a few, I have various lists depending on what you want here. So if we're talking about like actual school subjects, if you're going sort of like homeschooling as opposed to like unschooling or home ed, I do have to say I love the phrase home ed as opposed to homeschool. You guys have got like just you've got it down in this country, and I just hope nobody messes it up. So Progressive Phonics is a website that I highly recommend if you are teaching children to read. I tried two different sort of big textbook-based, I think Milo did Teach Your Child to Read in 100 Easy Lessons.
I knew you were going to bring that one up.
Yeah. Ramona did a different one that was similar, and she kind of did a bit better with it, but they both progressed to, well, Milo just got bored, and Ramona's progressed to a point where it was too hard, too fast. Progressive yeah. Phonics, although it is, I think, done by an American woman, and her... phonetic spelling out of how you say the sound is possibly even still wrong. You don't say puh, which is how she'll phonetically spell it. You say p, and you just make the sound. You know what I mean? Like that. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a tricky job to do. So I'm not trying to say, I shouldn't say wrong, but, you know, you just bear in mind what you know about good phonics when you go into the program. But yeah. The actual stories that she writes and illustrates, and it's one of those ones where the child will just read whatever words they're learning that week or that day, right. And you read all the ones in between. Mm-hmm. And they're short, and they're usually funny, and they've worked for both my children because they're funny. They want to read the next one because it's funny. And it's like really childish humor, you know, like the cat's got spaghetti on its head or something. Do you know what
Excellent.
I mean? So,
yeah,
you know, nothing super complicated. And she has done an amazing job of including activity sheets that reinforce the phonics, handwriting sheets if you want to reinforce writing the words that they're learning. And she's got alphabet books even before that. So you just do one letter at a time. Flashcards again that you can print out that I usually make into like bingo games instead. Mm-hmm. So it's just really, really good. So that's worked for both my kids. And if you like sort of the jolly phonics route, and I know it's a pain to have to buy like all these books and then they use them and then they learn it. And then, you know, you've got all these books and what are you going to do? Because they don't want to read them again. These are all free. You just like download them to your tablet and you flick through them on like a PDF reader and you're done. And you can use as much of it or as little of it as you like. So I love that one. And then from there, as far as reading, I think Usborne sets are really good. So they have their very first readers, which again are like you read some of the words, they read some of the words. And then they're not any more complicated. They're just that little bit longer and the storyline's that little bit more involved and requires that little bit more patience. So I think they might be meant for 4-year-olds, but honestly, neither of my kids would have coped with that at sort of 4 or 5. And then, of course, Usborne does the big sets of young readers, which are really cool because you can get them in like all sort of like really girly books or all like boy books, which, you know, whatever that is. There was a set that had like lots of classics like The Railway Children and Wizard of Oz. And so that was really cool. So I love Usborne. I'm huge. Usborne fan, but I know everybody knows Usborne, but I'm just saying, if you find those books too hard, start with Progressive Phonics first, because they've got a long sort of incremental, slow incremental in the phonics. And then, so math, Life of Fred is Milo's absolute favorite. It's the only math program we've ever done where he's like, can I do another one? Can I do another one? Can I do another one? So if you like really story-based stuff, Life of Fred is great. I know that one's American, but there is an online seller, Conquest Books, who sells those books for like £13 a piece, which I think is the lowest I've ever seen them.
That's really good.
Yeah, because I know it does get really expensive to ship that stuff, but they've obviously like shipped it over in bulk, and so they dole them out a little bit at a time.
Yeah.
And Prodigy Math is another one that's an online program that doesn't teach you math, but you can tell it sort of what grade level your child is at. And it will reinforce math concepts, and it's, you know, like wizard battles online, and you win by getting your math problems right.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so Milo enjoys that because, you know, it's like Harry Potter-esque, and it just happened to have some math in it. And there are Facebook groups that you can join to buy that as a group buy, so you get that for like £15 for the year or something. So.
Oh, that's very good.
And then history, we do Story of the World. Not everybody loves it, but again, Milo's such a history buff that I think anything would work for him. But I like Story of the World. It's story, because, you know, it's story-based, obviously, and that seems to work for him. And it comes with a workbook, and he would probably do everything in the workbook if he could, which is why we could spend all day on it. That to keep it short, again, we could just pick and choose, and I tend to pick and choose the things that don't involve writing. Because that just is long and slow and painful. And then the only thing that I can say for English, because I still haven't mastered this one, you know, the sort of language arts, spelling, grammar, that sort of thing. Like you said, it's tools and it's repetition. But Mensa, which is like the U.S. Like super intelligent people, have a reading list called Excellence in Reading. So it's the Mensa for Kids Excellence in Reading, and they give you like this massive great big reading list, you know, if you need any help with books, which probably none of us do, this massive great big reading list by sort of a large age group. I think it's like kindergarten through third grade, so you're sort of anywhere in that range. You could read something that's really quite high for a first grader, not that that's, you know, bad for them, but it's all this these, you know, sort of like classic old picture books moving on into chapter books that they think are just, you know, really like mind expanding. And I have to agree with them. I think some of my like absolute favorite books from childhood are in the younger list. And my kids, you know, I'm surprised at the extent to which they've enjoyed them. And, you know, it's like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which is just like a brilliant book. It just is. And it's, you know, it's nice to see it on the Mensa reading list. And then for sort of non-standard academic resources, oh God, these are quite largely history-based as well. Let me have a look. So Time Compass with Pippo, which the last I saw, you can buy it online, like you download like the little MP3 or something. But I think you had to have an American bank account for that, sadly. But maybe if enough people write in and go, hey, this is really good, could you change that? Because it's all ancient history, little like 10-minute video clips. And in every new clip, they'll review the last clip, and then they'll go on to the next bit. And they're really good. They're obviously made for classrooms with like sort of the length that they're at. But it's a good way to squeeze in just like a little bit of history if you don't have a lot of time in the day. And then, so my youngest is really arty. I have a lot of like arty ones on here as well. There's a website called We Folk Art.
Oh, yes, I know that one.
You know Wee Folk Art? Yeah, she's great. So she's got, like, season by season, you know, it's got a book, it's got a supplementary book, and then she's got, like, an activity to go with that book for, like, every week of the year. So I've used that with both my children. So it's given us a really good book collection. It gave me great ideas for what to do for every week of preschool. Because actually, there's so much you could do with preschool. It's nice just to have somebody kind of spell it out for you and not have to think about it that hard.
Yeah, totally.
Preschool Prodigies is another online program. It makes it sound really highbrow, putting prodigies in the title, but it's a music program, and they do a lot of free videos on YouTube. So we've never actually paid for the program, although I've considered it a number of times. But they have enough free videos on YouTube, and they're a lot of fun because they teach the solfege hand signs. But they put them, they color code them, and they put them on the music scale so you can see where, you know, what note they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
So you just kind of like visually get used to it. And then they'll play like a song. You have to guess what the song is, and you know, it'll be like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star or something. And then they'll play it faster, which is just funny because you can't keep up. And both of my kids end up in fits of giggles by the end of it. So that's always nice. I see. Oh, I could go on, but I'll probably stop there. I'll give you two podcasts though, because I haven't gone into the podcast category. So there's Wow in the World, which is from NPR, which again is American based. If anybody else has like kids podcasts that are UK based, I would love to. I'm looking forward to hearing somebody mention some of those, because I found mostly US ones. So Wow in the World is really good, and But Why. But Why is great because they take questions from kids, all kinds of various questions that are along the same line, and then they, you know, talk to an expert who answers all the kids' questions, and, you know, they just piece it together in a way that kind of makes a bit of a logical, linear sense to answering, you know, kind of a larger question.
That's really cool.
So my kids really enjoy both of those. Whereas obviously Wow in the World being NPR is a bit more polished. They pick and choose the topic, and then they answer in a way that's child-friendly. And they'll cover things like scientific studies that have come out recently about the benefits of, you know, eating fish and fish oil or something like that was sort of the recent one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll stop there.
So book recs for read-alouds or for kids to read themselves?
Okay, well, I went with read-alouds.
Yeah.
I would say that personally I like to read aloud the old books where maybe the language is a little bit old-fashioned or a little bit, you know, sort of highbrow, and that maybe if they're reading it themselves they kind of find it a little bit dry or dull, because at least when you're reading it aloud you can sort of animate it, be a little bit dramatic. I say old books, I don't know how old they really are, but like Heidi,
yes.
Anything by Edith Nesbit, I love. Milo really liked The Five Children in It. Roald Dahl, I know it's not that old, but anything Roald Dahl is just fun to read aloud. I think that one covers all ages. Let's see, something like Wind in the Willows, Peter Pan, Alice in Wonderland, those things that were obviously written for children, but are just, you know, kind of really big and kind of old language. Rudyard Kipling. We really like Rudyard Kipling, but again, that's written in a really sort of weird, older language. Poetry, I think, is more fun read aloud. So my favorite poet for kids is Shel Silverstein.
Yeah,
because they're just funny. Well, we used to read them before bed, but the kids would end up in fits of giggles, and we realized that that probably wasn't very calming. Night Lights for reading aloud before bed, right, if you're trying to be calming. We really like the Night Lights ones. I know there's also like Buddha Before Bed or something, but some people say that one's like a little bit preachy.
Right.
So the Night Lights ones I don't find preachy at all, so I can vouch for those. They're really nice, sweet, sort of meditative pre-bed reading. And then The Book with No Pictures. Have you read that one?
No, I know of it, but I haven't read it.
Okay, so that one has to be read aloud. So that one is awesome. I can vouch for that one. My youngest is not very verbal. So, like, we tried doing sort of not even Narnia level, but something a bit less intense than that with her, and it just doesn't fly because she's very, very, very visual.
Yeah.
So we're still very much on picture books with her. So I would say There's a author and artist called Sarah Gibb, if you have a visual girl, because she does princess stories, but her visuals are amazing. So that's a nice one to read together, any of the ones by Sarah Gibb. And then, do you know Corey Rosenschwartz?
No.
So these are good books just for girls, because our whole like perspective on just about everything changed when we had a girl. So Corey Rosenschwartz writes a lot of sort of like martial arts based books. They're Ninja Red Riding Hood, The Three Ninja Pigs, and Hansel and Gretel Ninja Chicks. So the girl is the heroine in all the stories. And she's also got Goldie Rocks and the Three Bears. So that's like her one non-martial arts story. So all with positive girl messages.
Cool.
And then the Rosie Revere Engineer. Have you read those?
Yeah,
series?
So series.
Rosie and Iggy and Ada. We loved those ones. And then I just wanted to throw Dr. Seuss in here because I assume you guys can get Dr. Seuss in this country. Because these are my absolute favorites, and I force my children to listen to these. I think they look at, because these are all my old Dr. Seuss books, you see, and I think they look old, and so they choose not to read them.
Yeah.
But, like, The Lorax, Horton Hears a Who, and, like, Sneeches are just, they make me cry every time I read them, and I don't think any childhood is complete without those.
My dad sent us a big set of like all of them, like in small hardback versions of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, this, you have children now, this is, you have to have these. So it's like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Some of the other books are hard. Like, they're hard to read.
Oh, you're talking about like Fox and Socks?
Oh, Fox and Socks. I love Fox and Socks.
I love Fox and Socks.
Like, you know, that gets really good. That feels good. But things like If I Own the Zoo and things like that. Like, they're great stories, but, you know, they're a workout for parents reading them out loud.
Right. Yeah.
That's all right. That's not a problem. Parents need a workout sometimes. It's all good. But, indeed. You know.
I love Dr. Seuss.
There's nothing like it. That's the problem. You know, that's the thing. Like, if you don't read those, you miss out on that style, because there really isn't anybody else who captured.
No, exactly.
That very particular, you know, it's a unique way of using words. And I can't think of anyone else who'd be like, oh, well, you could read Dr. Seuss, or you could read Sento. It's like, no, like, it's no. Dr. Seuss or nothing with regards to that.
Yeah. I mean, and he has so many good ones.
Yeah.
But those ones in particular, the ones that I listed, are the ones that I just, I mean, maybe it's just because I'm sentimental, but they do make me tear up. The good life's lessons amongst the goofy.
I was going to say, yeah, he talks about really important things, but he talks about things, and he explains it in a way that kids can understand.
Exactly. They enjoy the story, and they seem to ingest the message in a very, not like in your face, overly done sort of way.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Okay, so I'm sorry for my massive recommendations list. Don't get me started on books.
Oh, yeah, it's a really hard ship to have massive lists of recs.
Half our shelf is sitting next to me, so I can read you my list of recommended books.
These obviously will all be in the show notes, so I hope nobody's frantically scribbling, because there will be links to everything
in the show notes.
It's not a problem. Yeah,
good,
totally. Kate, thank you so much for coming and being on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I've enjoyed it. Not nearly as nerve-wracking as I feared.
Yay!
Because you're so easy to talk to.
And there you go. If you want to find out more about any of the things we talk about in this episode, or to leave a comment, please go to the show notes on the blog at learninginanoxfordkitchen.co.uk and click on the link to the Home Ed Voices podcast, or follow the link on Instagram at Home Ed Voices podcast, or Twitter at Home Ed Voices. This is episode 7. If you want to support the show, please rate and review at Apple Podcasts, as it helps more people to find out about it. The Home Ed Voices podcast is an independent production and is created, hosted and produced by me, Katie Hanrot. The podcast theme tune is Hope for Tomorrow by C-Stock. You can subscribe to the podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or anywhere else where podcasts are found. I'm off on a month-long hiatus now to find more people to interview, but I'll be back with episode 8 on the 4th of September. And until then, here's to more home ed adventures.